Gesellschaft besser machen. In weniger als 30 Minuten. Der Körper-Kurz-Podcast.
Botond Roska ist unser neuer Körperpreisträger. An seinem Institut, dem IOB, erforscht er in Zusammenarbeit mit der Uni Basel das menschliche Auge. Durch innovative Ansätze ist es dort gelungen, blinden Patienten das Augenlicht zu schenken. Im Gespräch erklärt der Ungar in englischer Sprache mit anschaulichen Metaphern, wie sie das geschafft haben. On today's episode, the winner of the Körberpreis, Botond Roska. Congratulations, and as we say in Hamburg, moin, or in English, hello.
Hello, thank you very much.
Let's dive into your scientific work right away. You are fascinated by the human vision, and two-thirds of your work is all about understanding the basics of vision. And your specific field is the retina. When I hear retina, it always comes to my mind that Apple uses retina as the name for its display. Have you got any clue why they use retina, since it's not the human eye, but it's technology?
Maybe I would like to start to specify what is my field of research.
Yes.
We do work on the retina. I would say half of my laboratory works on the retina, but the other half works on other parts of the visual system. So our focus is understanding vision. And the reason we spend so much time on the retina, because almost all diseases of the visual system arise in the retina. But my laboratory works on also on the visual cortex and the thalamus, which are part of the visual pathway.
The brain.
Mm-hmm. Now, the idea of Apple to call the display retina, I think the reason they did it, because the human retina has very high resolution, so they wanted to show that their display have high resolution. But they probably didn't know about it. Calling the whole device a retina would have been a good idea, not just a display, because a retina is a computer. This is not a screen. This is a massive computer that's a part of the brain that sort of was pushed forward. It does have a camera on it, the photoreceptors,
right.
But most of the retina indeed is not a camera, but a computer.
Mm-hmm. So from my understanding, the retina is 5 layers. What I learned at school is that there are what we say in German, Zapfen and Stäbchen, which is cones and rods in English. They are responsible for the perception of colors and sharpness. And then the rods are about brightness. So they enable us to see when it's really, really dark and we don't have much light. This is pretty much what I know about the eye and how we perceive everything around us. So I wonder if this is what you are interested in and if one of those two are the ones that interest you more.
For humans, definitely the cones are more important.
Okay.
In diseases where the rods are all dysfunctional, they're not dead, but they're dysfunctional, vision is close to normal.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you lose the function of cones, you're essentially blind. For us, we really would like to have a cone vision. The reason rods are important, because sometimes when rods die from a disease, as a bystander, the cones are all affected.
Mm-hmm.
So we would really always like to preserve cones, but sometimes in order to preserve cones, we have to preserve the rods. Again, both is interesting in terms of disease, but for vision, cones are the winners.
Just as a reminder, the cones are responsible about the colors and the sharpness in
high resolution, right? There is a part of your retina called the fovea, or also the macula, which has essentially only cones, but a lot of cones. And this is the part of the retina that we use for high resolution vision. So when you look at a face, when you read, you're essentially using these foveal cones for these activities.
Like the focus point, right? Because that's where you see very clear.
Correct. In this case, the whole retina is in focus, so the light is focused. But we have so many little detectors that we can resolve. Like a retina display has a lot of emitters. Our retina has a lot of sensors. So many that we can resolve very fine shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we can see very well, for example, a face or a letter.
But then there are some more layers, not only where the cones and the rods are based. There should be like 4 more layers, and they are all beforehand. So the cones and the rods are at the back of the eye, and the light falls onto them. But then what irritates me is that the whole system goes back to the front of the eye again. Can you explain a bit about that?
Yes. So the cones of the rods are the light sensors. The rest is a computer. So the rest, 4 layers.
Calculates.
So the retina is 5 layers. But that, just to remind you, the retina is around 100 cell types.
Yeah.
So 98 of these are not the photoreceptors, not the screen. This is the part of the computer. Now, nature, somehow in evolution, came up with an inverted design for the retina. and evolution led in insects to forward design. Therefore, the photoreceptors are in forward and the other layers mm-hmm. back. Now, why is that so? We can just speculate, but evolution is a random process. And so we ended up like this. Both is possible, as evidenced by insect has a forward design. We have a backward retina. It just happened to be like this in mammals.
There are about 100 different cell types, neuronal cell types in the eye. And the retina receives the information from the rods and the cones. And then, like a computer, they process them. And yeah. in the end, we have a moving image, just like a video. But the output are 30 different layers of this video. So how do these layers look like? How can I imagine them to be like? What's the difference?
Oh, so what's the difference? Imagine that one of these videos is a Photoshop operation. You know, Photoshop, you put in a face and you yeah. do something and another kind of face comes out. That's one operation. Right. Imagine 30 different Photoshop operations that, mm-hmm. although the same face is the input, but a bit different representation. So it's like 30 different Photoshops, except it's not a standing picture, but a video. So a little mm-hmm. bit the mental picture you can have that there's a politician who is speaking and there are 30 video cameras for 30 teams are looking at it. Mm-hmm. And the politician is saying something, but the interpretation that comes out in different channels is completely different, right? Depending on the left or the right or the center or who knows where or green or black on who knows what, that your interpretation of the same message is completely different. And the reason our retina is doing that, because each of these images that go out or these videos are very compressed. We have to describe with much less words, neuronal words, the outside world, then we can represent in a picture. If we would transfer all the picture that's arriving to the retina, we would essentially use all of our energy just to transfer these pictures via the optic nerves. We should eat like 15 times more or 100 times more per day just for that. So the good solution is there's a lot of redundancies. For example, you can look at the background here. This is a wall. It's a white wall.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can just tell you white wall. I don't have to describe every pixel like white. Doesn't make any sense. So you have, for example, in your retina, certain cells that when it's white, they are completely silent and they only emit fire here at the border of my face because suddenly it's not white. So you can describe the edges, that would make sense. Or there are some cells that only respond when I'm moving my head, a certain motion. Some of them has a directionality, probably this direction or that direction. So you sort of have very, very short description of the image and 30 such short description, but even this 30 is much less than pixel-wise description. Mm-hmm. It's a very efficient encoding of the image.
It's a bit like you breaking down the complex human vision for us.
Yeah.
I guess it's much more difficult to explain yeah. the exact process that's behind human vision. And I particularly like the Photoshop image because I wonder if we can add some layers that are like polish. You know, some things that I don't want to see, I just polish like in Photoshop. That would be ideal.
Yeah.
But let's talk about not so much polishing, but rather about the things that can go wrong. So what are the most common defects within this complex system?
There are three major defects. One that is not a big deal in the Western world, but still in Africa and in developing countries, a big problem, which is a problem with the lens. You know, the camera has a lens. And when this lens gets blurred, this causing cataract. And in the Western world, the solution is entirely simple. We exchange it to an artificial lens. In a cataract surgery, it's done and you will have amazing vision. Now, in some countries where there's not enough money, that is a major problem. The two leading problems in the Western world is the diseases of the photoreceptors with the screen when the mm-hmm. cones or the rods have problems. If the rods has only functional problems, we can still have the cones. But if the rods die, they usually lead to the dysfunction of cones. So again, the cone problem is the second one. For example, macular degeneration at the center where you lose your ability to read and to recognize faces is mm-hmm. a major societal problem, and millions of people affected. And then another one where again, millions of people, when it's a problem of the ganglion cells, this is the last cells of the retina, which form these videos that talk to the brain. And mm-hmm. when they have a problem, then the optic nerve degenerates and therefore whatever message is formed by the retina cannot reach the brain.
This is a particular problem that you deal with these days, or is it just the most common one?
These are the most common ones. So I would say that until now, until the formation of my new institute, IOB, which we founded together with Hendrik Scholl, co-director of IOB, who's a clinician, I personally never dealt with these big diseases, because for an individual lab, they are incredibly hard even to touch them, because there are no good animal models. For genetic diseases or monogenic diseases, when it's a single gene responsible, there are good animal models. In order for these diseases to be studied, we need a whole institute, and even for that is really, really difficult. Imagine a mathematical problem that is unsolved for 300 years. When you get a solution, everybody celebrates, like the Fermat's problem or other famous old problems. Now, macular degeneration and glaucoma are unsolved since humanity is around. So it is a difficult problem. And we have really no clue what is the mechanism, neither of them. And we have no way of solving them currently. In macular degeneration, we can delay the degeneration, and that's very important, by an injection to the eye of an antibody. But we do not understand what leads to the death of these cells, and we don't understand how to prevent this death.
So we can help, but we can't heal.
Exactly, for one of them. We can actually, in both of them, we can help. We can decrease the pressure. So what we can do is sort of push it further. So if I would get this disease, let's say, in the age of 60, now I might get the blinding condition in the age of 70, but still there is no solution for these problems.
However, there are some impressive solutions that you have come up with. And in 2008 already, you extracted a light-sensitive protein of a green algae, and that helps the eye to compensate the loss of cones, which are, as we've heard, so important, and of the rods. If I get this right,
yeah, first of all, it was not me who extracted from the algae. The discovery of this specific channel was my colleague in Germany, Ernst Bamberg, who is now retired, but has been a Max Planck director in Frankfurt. So we owe a lot to his discovery of this algal light-sensitive channel, this protein. Now, we don't work with the protein, but with the gene. What we have been doing is taking the gene that can make such a protein, and we insert it into a gene therapy vector and then inject into the eye. There are two important components. We put in a little genetic address that although this gene therapy vector enters all retinal cells, it's only making the light-sensitive protein in a particular cell that we want.
Right.
So for some of the surviving cells, so even if rods are all dead and cones are all dead, we can make another cell called a bipolar cell light-sensitive, or a ganglion cell. Now, in some cases, the cones are still alive, but they are light insensitive, so we can resensitize them. So the whole trick here is to express a light-sensitive protein in the cell that we want by a simple injection. And this is done by genetic engineering, and this took quite a number of years to arrive to patients and then to further improve the procedure.
It sounds a bit like the door is almost closed. There is almost no light coming in, but then you insert the gene and that helps maybe even the rods and the cone to function. But even if they don't function, it would help the client or the patient to regain some of his vision, right?
Yes, correct. Because there is a computer, and one layer of computer sends his light. Now, maybe it's completely scratched off. There is no more that layer, but we made another layer light sensitive. And now the computer again works, maybe less as before. So the very best solution, if the cones are still alive, they lost their vision, but we reinsert visual ability, and then they just drive the computer as they would normally drive. Now, importantly, this is only works, this therapy, in completely blind patients because we need a bright light. There is actually a goggle that has a video camera and that shines in a particular wavelength light. As you tell that, it's a green algae. It requires a particular wavelength. And this therapy is a combined therapy when you need a goggle and an injection. Now, you mentioned it's a green vision.
Exactly. So I wonder if you just see green afterwards.
No. In order to see green, you need more than one photoreceptor. Because you have to say it's green, that means it's not red, right? You already know green is not something else. So in order to see a color, you need at least two photoreceptors, and one is different from the other one. Basically, at least four photopigments, one in rods and three in cones. But these re-engineered patients will have only one wavelength currently. It's not impossible to have more, but current treatment, we have only one. So it's a grayscale. Imagine that you're looking at a photograph, the color photograph, and you turn off the colors, you still see, but there is less shades. Contrast because there is no color, but grayscale.
However, if you would inject it into my eye, would I see green? Because I can see colors, obviously.
That is a very, very interesting question. And depends of exactly where we inject. Mm-hmm. If we would inject, for example, in bipolar cells, I could not tell what you would see. Color vision is something we really don't understand. And we have some ideas how color vision works, but it's really preliminary in humans. The only way we would know that you would tell us what you see, and then we would understand what we have done.
Exciting, but I'd rather not have the surgery or the injection.
Yeah.
Because I do get the shivers about everything that comes to surgery around the eyeball. And therefore, I was absolutely mind blown by some of the methods that you use. You don't really use a lot of surgery within the eye. Or if I think of you help the retina to improve because it's the skin, I would think, okay, you cut off something of my eye or of my face and you replace it. But that's not what you do. You have a genetic therapy that uses a virus to heal. And I wonder how this works.
There are two kinds of injection. In each case, of course, the needle goes to your eye. That is completely standard. So my colleague, Hendrik Shore, every Monday, it's a 10-minute surgery. They prepare you in, out. Every ophthalmologist in Germany would do that in macular degeneration with this antibody I mentioned to you. This is completely standard. You would feel close to nothing. It's anesthetized. And now, for gene therapy, you either do this simple one just in the eyeball, or you have to go under the retina. When you go under the retina, you need much more elaborate surgery. But again, it's just an injection. Where you inject, there's no replacement of tissue. The virus, we call it a virus. It's not a real virus. It used to be a virus which is heavily genetic engineered. It cannot replicate. It doesn't have side effects as a virus. So especially now in corona time, you think about viruses as very bad things. Viruses, of course, surround us all over. And this is a so-called dependovirus. Cannot replicate. And all the genes are removed. It's just a delivery vehicle. And this delivery vehicle, we engineer completely on computers. You make everything on your computer, you test it out, then you make these viral particles. These are just little balls that have a piece of DNA, and that's what it is.
Just to dive into it a bit more, it's like the shell, the outer shell of the virus. You use it because it has the ability to go into the right spot that you want it to go. And that's the advantage of using a virus, right?
I tell you what's the advantage of virus. To enter a cell is very difficult. The cell is surrounded by the membrane. We want to go into the cell.
Yeah.
Medicine couldn't come up with this for things very long time. The very first time we can enter cells is by viruses, because evolution, it took millions of years of messing around until there was a particle that has ability to bind. So in order to enter a cell, you have to bind, then the cell eats it up. It's a naturally cells, when whatever they bind, cells usually eat it up if it's small enough. Mm-hmm. But then they are trapped in a trash can and you have to get out from the trash can. If it would all artificially build, it's possible, but it probably would take us also a couple of million years. This is done by evolution. So we just take this little ball that is so well made by this randomness that it can not only enter a cell, but also can come out from the garbage can.
Ah.
And this is not so simple. Entering cells is rather simple. You know, getting out of the garbage can is not so simple.
Okay.
So this ball is for us, is like there was an engineer called evolution. We take it and we can also further make it better. And a lot of biological engineers are working, make even better balls. They do many, many variants and they all test them out. Mm-hmm. And then inside, the virus is packing into a DNA strand, which we engineer. But how it packs it, this is, again, we don't fully understand.
So it's actually your virus, but a good virus, because it's not a virus. It's just the content is what you put in, and it's a DNA that will help to improve vision.
Yes, exactly. At the end, it's a delivery vehicle, the shell, which is small enough so it can go to a lot of cells and can enter them. And then there's a DNA, and we engineer DNA that has almost nothing left from the virus, except of the packing sequences. It has an address that we engineer, and it has a gene that we engineered in, namely this light-sensitive channel.
It's only the good things of the virus, and you just said it's almost nothing left of the virus. So just to be clear, once again, there is no risk of a virus or an infection, or is
again,
there?
We have to say that this is a particular one that is used already in many, many clinical trials.
Right.
It's not true that viruses in general are not. There is a one particular one, one single one we know so far, which is used in gene therapy, or maybe two.
Right.
it's a lentivirus and adeno-associated viruses, these, when injected in humans, especially adeno-associated viruses, they can cause a mild immune reaction in the eye, in the many injections people, others, and we have done. This is really minor, and in most cases, there is no reaction to it. But it's a very lucky situation, and humanity took a long time to come up with that one, the adeno-associated virus, which is one single one out of the millions of viruses. So a lot of insight for many, many researchers over tens of years.
And there's more good news to it, because from what I know is that you test if the content you made, so not the virus, but the good genetic content, if it works on a specific patient, because you test it in vitro, so in the laboratory.
Yeah, that is correct. One of the major advances in our field in the last 3-4 years, which we are also advancing together with others, is to have the ability to study human retinas. And before that, all our understanding came from animal models, such as mice. Mm-hmm. And what we really learned, that testing gene therapy in mouse is, at the beginning you have to do it because access of human retina is not so easy, but it's crucial to test the gene therapy in human retinas. Only developing mouse would lead 100% to failure, since these gene therapy vectors, these viruses, are very species specific. And so we really have to test. Now, how can we test in human retina? There's two ways. The most important is that we get donations, eye donations from multi-organ donors. Mm-hmm. And the reason we get the retina, because the cornea is used for corneal donations, so we can get a piece of retina from these donations. These retinas can be kept alive by a method that a colleague of mine developed, and then on that we can test these viruses. And this is important because these are adult retinas that already they developed. They were in humans. We can test on them. When we have a correct targeting and they work, we know that there's a high chance they will work in patients. The other way is that nowadays we can build human retinas in a dish. And this is some of that my institutes and my laboratory works a lot, that now we can build from a skin biopsy or from a blood donation, from the blood cells of skin cells, from a particular patient, tens of thousands of human retinas called organoids in a dish.
Sounds pretty hard to get and also sounds very costly. So you just won the Kerber Prize, which comprises 1 million euro. And I wonder how this can help to develop your work further and what are the next big projects that you're working on and the current project as well.
I'm extremely happy about this 1 million euro. It will be all spent on studying the human retina. So I told you that we now work out the methodologies, how to understand mm-hmm. the human retina, but we now really have to start a painstaking long-term project to describe the human retina. I think the good news is that I will not finish it. We will start it, but any information we gain for the human retina, since humans evolve very slowly in millions of years, will be useful information for the next million years, we think, for the incoming generation of medical researchers and medical doctors.
And this is one thing that you have been doing for quite some time. So for 3 years now, you've been working hand in hand with clinics and hospitals. How has this been helpful and why did you start that?
Yeah, it's incredibly helpful. So the idea came up between Hendrik Scholl, who is a clinician, and myself, who is a medical researcher, trained as a medical doctor, but my time is on research. And the basic problem what we wanted to address is that in order to treat diseases, the researchers have to know about the unmet medical need. They really should understand. And if you're not with patients and you don't discuss day by day with medical doctors who see patients, this just doesn't happen. So there's a very big gap that researchers work often on problems which they try to figure out are important for medicine, but often they are not. And the other side of the problem, that medical doctors who do clinical research, they are not aware of the latest technologies and developments, and they go extremely fast sometimes. So these medical doctors, they believe what you can do is like 10 years or 20 years back of knowledge. So the idea is to bring the two together and form a chain that from the basic understanding, the development of new ideas for therapies to the actual development of therapy, to the testing in patients, it's all in one institute. And it's visibly, it's openly, you can look at the different part of the chain, how we arrive from understanding to therapy.
A very powerful exchange, also when it comes to technology, I suppose, because very often doctors won't have access to the latest technology and therefore they can't treat their patients with it. What else is interesting is the connection to the patients, because I wonder if the patients feel more integrated and less left alone as they are part of the process and part of research.
Definitely. And I give you a very concrete example. A few days ago, there have been a young, extremely intelligent Swiss lady who has been a few years ago diagnosed with a cone and rod, so a photoreceptor mutation causing retinitis pigmentosa, one of these blinding diseases. At that time, we offered her to take her skin, and she was just here after 2 years to visit again Hendrik Scholl at the clinic. And meanwhile, the head of translation at IOB, Bente George, developing a new therapy concretely for this particular mutation, which is a very rare one. Now she walked by after seeing Hendrik Scholl to me, and I showed her her own retinas in a dish, hundreds of them, and then explained the therapy that Bente is developing. And this is very important to have these few examples. It's very different to look at an organoid when the patient is next to it. And it's also very interesting for the patient that now I see hundreds of my own retina swimming in a dish, and people working on my disease, on my mutation. So it is very powerful. Now, of course, we will not be able to treat all individualized, every mutation. We always have to focus on main therapeutic routes that would benefit most patients.
So it's a total win-win situation. And I wonder, how does this feel for you when you see this change happen in the patient and also in medicine?
This is extremely rewarding. I mean, it's a lot of work. I work basically Monday to Sunday. When I'm not sleeping, I'm working since a long time. And this is the true reward. We will not be able to bring back complete vision. But the first steps and the whole field moving now really fast, this is happening in the last 5 years. You know, 10 years before or 15 years before was just preparation. And now we can see the steps happening all over in the world. Some of the ideas we had, you know, in 2008, at that time, people thought we completely lost our mind. In conferences, when I told people that we would put something from genealogy in the eyes of people, thought that you know, this guy is nuts.
Crazy.
And now the same colleagues are doing exactly the same around the world. So I think that this is very nice. And again, this is a very slow process, but amusingly, a first time in history, we say that these things are happening in the eye that we could not have imagined 10 years before.
What a great success. And you yourself had to deal with some sort of impairment, not so much about the eyes, but you gave up your career as a musician due to a hand injury. You still play the cello, but you had to stop your studies. And looking back, I wonder if you wish you had a transgen or one of those good viruses healing your hand.
I think at that time, I would have been really enthusiastic about it and have definitely tried, because I tried everything that was that time possible to save my cello career. But looking back now, I have a really exciting job. And I think that, you know, these are randomness of life. Very different to be blind than having a problem with your thumb. So we cannot compare the two.
Fair enough. I think you yourself wear glasses at times, right?
Yes, I do. I need glasses for seeing faces far away. But when I look at the computer, then I would not see you with the glasses. So it's a typical problem of neither glasses nor without glasses is good.
It's something common that as we get older and since we daily use technology and screens, that our vision has dramatically decreased. So myopia, or in other words, nearsightedness, has increased. I wonder if there's something that all of us here, even if we have a perfect vision at this time, can do to help us remain this good vision, or at least not worsen our bad vision.
There is, and there are two things we can do. For myopia, unfortunately, it only works in kids. When you are children, you have to be outside. For a reason we don't fully understand, but clearly, the more time a child spends outside, the less likely it gets myopia. Mm-hmm. Researchers will need a long time to figure it out why, but that's a fact. That's only in children. So if I have a myopia now, it's not gonna change anymore. But the second one, we know quite a lot about why macular degeneration develops, and is partly genetic, but partly environmental. And the environmental is very interesting. It has to do partly with diet. So Mediterranean diet helps tremendously to avoid macular degeneration. So if you don't have the wrong genes, you don't have to worry, but you don't know usually this. But for those who have the wrong genes, that's a lot of us, then if you're on a Mediterranean diet, that means we eat more fish, more plant-based food, and less dairy and less meat, then we can massively reduce the occurrence of macular degeneration. So there is an advice, go to Italy, learn what they do, come back and keep doing that.
I've heard that in several contexts now. It's also related to longer lives. On a personal note, I would like to know, and this goes into this direction, because my parents always told me to eat more carrots because that's good for the eyes. Also, they threatened me not to watch too much television because in Germany we say your eyes turn into rectangles if you watch too much TV. Is any of this right?
Well, I think that you have very intelligent parents. Maybe the eye was not the right explanation. For example, not watching TV, you might have spent time in the garden, so myopia would have been reduced. But also, I think not watching TV is incredibly good for your brain. I think that thinking alone or playing or doing things that you think come out and not go in is really good thing. So TV is destructive, I think, but mostly for the mind. Regarding carrots, I think it goes that the Mediterranean diet is very good. Now, we in the Western world had enough vitamin A, so carrots will further increase, but I don't think that's the key point. But carrot is very good. It's a plant. It's part of a plant-based diet, so it will be good for macular degeneration.
I'm considering more tomatoes and maybe even more pasta, but I'm not so sure if pasta is the right thing to eat when it comes to Mediterranean diet.
As long as you balance with a lot of tomatoes, you'll be all fine.
Maybe a bit more fish and less meat.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for all these insights and the precious work you do. We are much looking forward to welcome you in Hamburg on the Körber Prize ceremony next Monday, September the 7th. There will be a live stream available on our website and a recording, just in case you've missed it. I can't wait for your next findings. Botond Raska.
Thank you very much.